And here's Derek Christensen once again. Thank you, folks.
Thank you, Derek.
Dan and I are going to split this session, and in interest and in time, I think what we're going to do is I'll probably speak till maybe about 4:15, about 20, 25 minutes. We wanted to have a couple things at this last session. One is Dan's going to talk a little bit about the research efforts in the BFA, and they asked me to talk a little bit about specific protocols for different types of crops, and I think it was kind of a nice segue. In terms of Brian really kind of introducing some of the finesse and the massage of fruiting crops and leaf crops and so on and so forth. So I just want to kind of spend a brief moment looking at some of those from maybe a stronger mineral perspective and discuss, you know, what we're doing on the farm for those different types of crops. Now, there's folks that are kind of the followers of Albrecht that are really into mineral balancing that will swear that the same soil that will grow the best tomatoes can grow the best blueberries and can grow the best garlic, and you know, like there's this uniform ideal window. And in reality, why I haven't necessarily found that not to be the case, what we've found on our farm is that if we're going to make strategic fertility investments, we're always going to make those investments. That's the joy of having a really small operation, is we can make those investments on a per section or a per bed basis. And what that means is we can be real targeted how we're going to spend our fertility dollars. We don't have to be giving crops that might only be in the ground for a month the same kind of fertility approach that a tomato crop or a potato crop gets. And that's something that I think is valuable to think about if we're going to work with that biological system, because ultimately that equilibrium I think John Slack was talking about is we're going to have different needs, and we're going to have to be thinking about how we're going to have different needs. Now, conventional organic, I use that term, conventional organic, right? The traditional organic, dyed in the blood, these have folks been growing organic, certified for a long time, right? The traditional way of doing this, and I think is a lot of merit, is thinking about crop rotation. And we did a really nice job with that when we were in New York at Hawthorne Valley, where we would do an 18-month fallow. We'd come in with winter rye and normally a clover seeded in September of one fall. The following spring, we'd mow off the rye before it seeded out. And then we'd keep the clover. We actually would normally bale the clover for the cows. And then we'd go that the entire year, and then the following May, so about almost 18 months after the initial seeding date, we'd turn that clover in. And it was a pretty good clover sod at that point, so we weren't going to turn it in and try and plant 2 weeks later. We're going to let it work down. And that was always universally in our rotation there what preceded our fall brassicas. And, you know, consistently nice plate-sized heads of broccoli if you want to sell plate-sized heads of broccoli. We sold broccoli at, it's like $4 or $4.50 a pound down in Union Square. So, like, broccoli was pretty much gold on the farm, right? And so we can do a lot with our fertility programs through just rotation. And we're going to keep that in mind. And, you know, that's obvious. It's the same thing we would do on our farm. You might have spots that are high fertility. You might have spots that are low fertility. And we'd go through that every year in our planting cycle. If the cucumbers were in that side of the farm, we'd only need, you know, 80% of the bed feet to get our yields. But this spot may be lean, a little bit leaner. So we got to bump the bed space that we're going to do. So I just want to talk briefly about what we're thinking about here. What are we going to manage for? Are we going to just do a one-time harvest? You know, fertility protocols, if you just want a head of lettuce and get it done, is going to be much different than something like a head of a kale plant that you're going to be harvesting off of the whole season. Or if you want to have a fruiting crop that wants to produce. Record keeping is always a challenge for a lot of small farms. I guess one of the joys of starting out at Waltham Fields, we did a lot of crop donations, so we were super meticulous with our record keeping, scaling everything that came off the farm. So I've been on places like that, and it helped me understand the importance of data collection. And so when it comes to a fruiting crop like a cucumber or something like that, you know, it's nice for me to gauge on an annual basis, like how long are we consistently picking a cucumber bed? Are we getting that for 3 weeks? Are we getting it for 6 weeks? What's that yield like? And do we want to do more to manage? Normally on my farm, where we've often been on these soils that don't really have a maturity to their fertility protocols, the easiest way for me to consider that I'm going to have good, efficient harvesting is multiple successions of crops, right? And trying to pick out, so if we're doing squash and zucchini, we're doing three successions over the course of the year, so I never have to feel like it's a slow pick through the field. Now, it all depends on what your land base is like. It all depends on, you know, the type of farm that you want to have. But more often than not, for most commercial growers, it's you don't pick till the last fruit's on the vine. You stop picking when it's not economical. So what are we thinking about when we're thinking about minerals for leaf crops? We want to encourage this vegetative growth. I think Brian talked a lot about that nitrogen. For me, it's figuring out those minerals that work within nitrogen within the plant to balance it. And somebody asked a little bit more about the aphid conversation earlier. Molybdenum is the trace mineral that's forgotten about. And people have heard me speak about this before maybe, but it's standard practice in the conventional ag industry, if you're growing soybeans in the Midwest, to be supplementing your seed with a sodium molybdate. Especially if the pH of your soil is low, which tends to reduce molybdenum availability. And they do that, of course, because molybdenum is a key to this nitrate reductase enzyme where they get a yield response. They get better nodulation if they have that molybdenum in the soil. You can get better molybdenum levels, better availability, you know, using kind of John Slack principles by making sure you have adequate calcium in your soils that brings that pH up to increase that availability. If you do a malic soil test, a lot of people have been doing this since Dan's been recommending you get molybdenum levels that are not very high. And so anytime that I want to push nitrogen because I want to have this explosive growth, and I'm doing this, again, partially from an economical standpoint, which is real estate. And that real estate is not just a finite location, it's a space and time. And so for me, if I want to double crop a crop, I want to make sure I can get that first crop off in a timely fashion. So I'm thinking about making sure that I'm going to get to that next crop. And it might be that next crop is a cover crop, but I want to get that seeded down before it gets too late into the fall. Sodium molybdate, organically approved source of molybdenum for farms. Kelp, of course, was mentioned, sea minerals, that kind of thing. We're going to put a little bit of that on. We're going to always have sulfur to balance nitrogen. Oftentimes for me, and I'll talk about this just briefly, is talked a little bit about the sulfate forms of sulfur. If you're putting on sulfate forms of sulfur, they can leach quite readily. And it's your organic matter, your humus, that stores the sulfur in your soils. So the better job you can build that up, the better you can create your storehouse of sulfur. But if in the early stages, or if you're farming, you know, some of the soils around us have these CECs of like 5 and 6 and relatively low organic matter soils. Those are soils that have a hard time storing sulfur. And so what we've been doing with our approach in this idea of balancing that nitrogen is we're always introducing a little bit of elemental sulfur, which takes bacteria to make it available. And those bacteria only get active, they really get going when the soils are above 70 degrees. So that elemental sulfur on my not really well matured soils, low organic matter or low level of kind of active organic matter, that elemental sulfur is a way for me to help balance that nitrogen load that I'm going to get later in the growing season. Again, for leaf crops, normally we're still getting paid for the volume or the weight of things that we're producing. Most farms, that's how it works for the marketplace. Zinc plays a big role in helping auxin develop in the soil, in the plants, excuse me, which is going to be the hormone related to growth of the leaf size. And we saw this really well this fall because we had a part of our new field that I talked about a part that we hadn't fertilized at all. Well, the real story to that was we were going to double crop another part of our farm, and it was a little bit late because of the cold soils and dry conditions. So we decided the part that we originally were going to cover crop this year, let's just put it into production this year. Let's see how it does. But we made that decision mid-July after we'd kind of used a lot of our fertility inputs. So we had to skimp. And so we had beds where we were able to run trials, where we're going with, this was brand new fields for us, and it was putting down lime with a little bit of composted chicken manure, and that was it. And then we had beds that we did lime and we did chicken manure and we did our other trace mineral protocols, a little bit of zinc sulfate, a little bit of copper sulfate, some of these other things that we know are important for kind of driving the enzymatic activities of our crops. Zinc, if you really see a serious zinc deficiency, it's called little leaf. You get this rosetting of the leaf, it's very small, you don't have that development of size. And we could tell it, although it wasn't necessarily in a little leaf stage, the beans that we seeded into that fall crop where we hadn't put zinc into the mix. From a mineral standpoint, calcium will help reduce zinc availability when you apply calcium. Where we hadn't put zinc into the mix, there was definitely, I wouldn't call it a stunting, but a smaller size to that leaf. And then the foundation of almost everything, and I try not to get into one mineral is more important than the other, but the foundation of everything in terms of high quality growth, good sugars, good flavors, are calcium and phosphorus. They're just so important, the two of those together. So no matter what crop we're working with, that's the underlying current. And I talked about reams, calcium. So for us, where we're trying to do mineralization into a soil that maybe doesn't have a lot of calcium, we have two situations on our farm. We have one part of the farm that's been limed really well with dolomitic limestone. And on a Malic test, it's going to have 20% magnesium. A little bit tight, although it doesn't mind to be tight because it's a well-drained soil. But that high level of magnesium in those parts of the farm, we know we need to push a little bit more nitrogen to balance that magnesium out. In the new part of the farm that hasn't had lime in 15 or 20 years, the pH was pretty low. We need to bring some calcium in. And we're going to use a high calcium limestone, but we're also going to introduce gypsum as a calcium sulfate source. We're going to introduce a little bit of carbonatite and all these other things. The idea is, I don't fully understand how all this biology is going to work, but what I have thought is diversity is kind of exciting, and a diversity of different forms of materials is exciting. Of course, the value of doing this on high-value vegetables is we rarely have to like question, is it economically affordable? John Slack was talking about, you know, like it doesn't make sense to ship soft rock phosphate. It's not economically viable, but on high-value vegetables, you can pretty much get away with doing anything. You know, because compare that to the potato growers in Aroostook County, 6 to 12 cents a pound, and we're selling our potatoes at the roadside stand at $2 a pound. So we have a lot more flexibility to be kind of stupid, if you will. Bulbs and rooting crops. These are things like beets, carrots, onions, parsnips. The key with these is you're looking at what do we want to do to emphasize the movement of sugars and other photosynthates into the storage vessels. And so the calcium and phosphorus is always there. Again, the phosphorus is going to be key to that sugar production, but we really need to emphasize having good levels of potassium and good levels of boron, because both are going to play key roles in making the sugar go down from the leaf into the roots. The recommendation for potassium, if you're growing a sugar beet crop, not that anybody's in North Dakota growing sugar beets, but if you're growing sugar beets or any of these things where they're getting tremendous yield of a storage sugar, often they're recommending 400 to 500 pounds of potassium to the acre to get those yields. And if you have a sandy soil, go back a few steps, if you have a low CE soil, doesn't have a lot of clay and organic matter in it, there's no way you're going to be able to store that much potassium in your soil. And that's going to give you a red flag that says, you know what, potassium's important if we want to move all those sugars. And here's the thing, right, John Kemp has talked about this, any of these sinks, once that potassium moves into the root, it tends to not get mobilized back out. It's a function of temperature. When the soil, and when it's warm at night, like 70 degrees, that's why your carrots don't taste good in the summertime, is the sugars aren't getting stored. The plant's not going into storage mode. You need those cooler nights. Not that you think of 60 degrees as a cooler night, but you need it below 70 to get the sugars to be stored. If you're on that light soil, you're working and you want to have these massive storage crops, you're going to have to think about side dressing or bringing something in. Compost is a great way to get potassium into the mix. And then our fruiting crops, and we've played with this a little bit to the extreme. Some people maybe have seen pictures in the past. I like to have a picture of a cherry tomato that we had a few years back. That in early August, it was a, trying to think of the variety, yellow mini from Johnny's, and the lower ones were fruiting and maturing. We had about 40 fruit on a double split truss on the base. That's what we were harvesting. And we were doing some foliar sprays, right? Some of this stuff, not exactly always working with Korean natural farming principles, but other types of ways to get that crop to say, yes, I want to reproduce. And at the time that we were doing that, we were pushing things to an excess. There were points there where the top, and I have a picture, is a flower that's branched about 12 or 11 times, and there were over 100 blossoms. There's a cherry tomato on that, and this was early August. And the reality was, again, we're not irrigating. There's nowhere near enough energy to mature 100 fruit on that truss in an early to mid-September maturation cycle. What we do with that, we just picked cherry tomatoes till later in the season, and then, you know, whatever, the cherry tomatoes, a lot of those aborted the fruit because the plant was like, I can't do all this work. If you're putting water into that system, that makes a lot of difference because there's a huge water need as well going into the fruit cycle. But the idea here is that we are very aware that we can push that fruit energy if we want to. Phosphorus being that key in terms of reproduction, but also the trace minerals, manganese was noted because it's the key of that germ. You need that manganese there. Foliar spray of manganese sulfate, bring a manganese sulfate into your soils. If you go back to Arden Anderson, he talked about using royal jelly as like a really expensive source of manganese, but it gets you that fruiting energy. Copper and boron also play a role. So when we're looking at fruit production, there's that balance between vegetative and reproductive growth. And we have to figure out where we're going to push that balance. And in a management system where you have irrigation there, probably the easiest way to do that is through fertigation and to be thinking about what you're putting into that tank mix. Sometimes if you've got an overload of good available phosphorus, boron and some of these traces, that fruiting energy becomes too much. What you would do in the growing season is try and put the brakes on it a little bit with some calcium and some potassium. Nitrate form of nitrogen that's kind of got a vegetative growth response. Reams talked a lot about nitrates and ammoniums, the nitrates being in charge of this growth, the ammoniums as being that reproductive energy. Naturally, during the growing season, you hit a switch mark in the high summer where plants go into a more wanting to be in reproductive phase. And I think almost everybody's experienced that if you do successions of summer squash or zucchini, right? Your summer squash or zucchini, we tracked it last year. You know, your early succession planting that you put out in May and you're harvesting for us around Father's Day into mid-July, that plant is massive by the time it's starting to flower. And it's starting to crank out fruit and it just goes and goes and goes. A lot of times within an organic system, we don't always have a ton of nitrates in the later summer because we have a lot of our nitrogens getting developed through these more complex relationships. And for my money, experience has often been with our late successions of those squash and zucchinis, you have a hard time putting enough growth on that plant before it wants to go into the reproductive phase. It's flowering and fruiting, I think, you know, last year, 40, 42 days or something like that for a zucchini. And the problem, of course, with that is it hasn't been maybe making the root system that it needed to do that. So in the later part of the season, part of the idea might be trying to hold that back. Calcium is going to be a key element to balance and to buffer that, make sure you have good growth. What we've been doing to try to balance that, because a few years ago we really got away with it, is as a general rule, with our mineral mix fertilizer that we put on beforehand, is we'll mix a little bit of high calcium limestone in just into that top inch of the soil as we're planting. Right? The cucurbits are so good at making lateral root systems really shallow into the soil. And so I like to bring out that kind of fresh new calcium source to them. You could do it with gypsum or something like that, but the sulfur and the gypsum is probably going to give you a little bit more of a fruiting response. So bringing that high calcium lime on, not huge application rates, 500 pounds to the acre, but really shallow into that soil, so that plant has a continued nice supply of good sources of calcium. That's the short term. The long term is to get the fungal activity going. Did Dan come in? I'm gonna switch off in 5 minutes. Just to give you a heads up. I was going to talk about a crop, but I want to give somebody in the room an option to ask about one specific crop, and we'll just do a deep dive into that crop fertility-wise. So So I initially was going to talk about potatoes or celery, but I'd like to see if there's somebody in the room that would really like to talk about a specific crop. Noah? With sweet peppers. All right. It's not going to be a fair conversation, but I'm going to give you my experience of sweet peppers. And I say fair because it's pretty far from pharma's ecosystem. So this year we had our best sweet pepper crop ever. Sweet peppers were okay. The green peppers were phenomenal. In packing out in early July, mid-July, lots of jumbo peppers, big, thick-walled, gorgeous peppers. And here's our experience this year. This was on the piece of land that had been fertilized, managed for us for 4 years. And we planted down some sugar snap peas. It was pretty late. It was a late spring. So we planted these sugar snap peas, probably mid-April it was. And I wanted to run a trial based on fertility inputs in our peas. And we had three beds of peas side by side, sugar and bush peas. And so I said, we're going to do one bed, we're going to do nothing fertility-wise. And we're going to do another bed where we're going to do our crayers and our mineral mix. And we're going to do another bed where we're going to put it on just the crayers. So we had sort of three beds that had all been split up. Does that make sense? Well, we lost our pea crop to corn root maggot. If anybody has had problems with those types of flies, and the larva getting into a pea crop, seed corn maggot. We've had that on and off, an imbalance, I think, probably partially pushing some of that fish into the springtime maybe creates an environment that attracts those insects. So it was one of those things where like the crop, the germination wasn't really good. It was early May. They'd already come up, and I was like, you know what? I don't want to pick a crummy, I never want to have a bed of peas that's not just loaded with peas. It's just a waste of time to cultivate that. So I turned the pea bed in, and it was mid-May. We're going to get ready to plant peppers. These were our first succession. We do two successions of peppers. First succession of peppers, and I forgot to tell the crew that we had already fertilized those beds with these experimental trials. And so the crew came through and gave everything what we call the luxurious treatment, which is any of our nightshades, high-value fruiting crops. And I say luxurious treatment, that means we put soft rock phosphate on 1,000 pounds to the acre, in addition to maybe 200 or 400 pounds of bone char, so a good load of phosphorus up front, and crayers, composted chicken manure at 25 pounds a bed, which is, you know, maybe 1,000 pounds to the acre as well. And we put those peppers in the ground. I feel like it was a Friday, but say it was May 19th. It was pretty early in the season. We're going to row cover the peppers is the plan. We didn't row cover them because it got dark by the time we got finished planting, and I wanted to go home and have dinner. So I gave up on row covering them. And then a week later, I'm like, oh, we should still row cover those peppers, really push them along, right? But again, the row cover was at the time one of those windy days, and you're like, I don't want to deal with row cover. So then I decided, you know what, if we're not going to put row cover on, let's put a little extra nitrogen into the system. So I did. We side-dressed the bed pretty early in the game. First week of June, go through again, another 25 pounds of crayers. So the bed that had gotten, because I'd forgotten about the pea situation, the bed that had gotten that early dose, now at this point it's gotten 3,000 pounds of crayers with manganese as a trace mineral, and copper and zinc and all the good things we like to put in our mix, and kelp and, you know, things like that. Well, once those plants went through a slow transplant phase, because it was a little bit cool and it was pepper time, May 19th is kind of early to plant peppers where we are if you're not going to do anything for them, then they just started taking off and growing. And we had some chopped winter wheat that we're going to mulch with, so we're going to mulch that, so we mulched that down. But what happened with those peppers, it was originally going to be a pick-your-own bed. Half the field were hot peppers and mini sweets and lunch boxes, and then the back half were bells. And that back half, we had the best bell pepper crop in two of those beds. The gourmets, which was the one bed that didn't get that very first initial of crayers, that had been on the ground and in relationship with the soil for a month before the peppers had been planted, it never caught up yield-wise. But we had Flavor Burst and X3R and Olympus. Those were our varieties, you know, kind of standard Johnny's varieties. And all those guys were just totally cranking big, nice fruit. And we've always been told we don't have, you got to be careful to put too much nitrogen into your system. And my experience this year was, especially under dry conditions, is I probably have been underwhelming my nitrogen for my peppers when I'm working with a soil that's pretty dead to begin with. I mean, this has had a few years into production, but it's not anywhere near kind of like this culmination of things. So, what I've been sort of emphasizing is actually, it's okay, and this might be a little different than Brian's, but for me, it's okay to push my nitrogen as long as I'm balancing that with all these other minerals that are going to give me quality proteins. And all of these guys, the other thing that was nice is sometimes I've staked peppers in the past because they can get a little top heavy, but these guys for the most part held up throughout the growing season, even with really nice, you know, multiple big size fruit up on the top of the plant. Eventually they started kind of falling over a little bit in the fall. So next year we're going to do an experiment with the actual thought behind the exact same thing, which is we're going to push nitrogen in one bed and hold it back in the other bed and see for our situation if that's not, ironically enough, a limiting factor in a crop that everybody says you can't push too much nitrogen. We've always had enough fruiting energy. There's never an issue with not having enough flower, but having that thick wall and mobilizing enough energy so that that pepper could grow into a nice, thick, juicy, and because I don't really like green peppers, I like sweet peppers, but green peppers don't really like. But if they have a nice thick wall, they can actually be halfway decent. So that's my bet. In the past, I've always used black plastic if I wanted to get a better pepper crop. But a few years ago, I decided I'd rather be able to undersow clover instead of using black plastic. So we quit using black plastic. A lot of people around us are using landscape fabric with peppers for that reason. This year we decided to mulch with our winter wheat because we wanted to play around with that. Every year, I think I'll probably go back to putting clover underneath my peppers. And it worked out pretty well. We definitely, we hit a dry spell in August and September where we didn't get much rain from basically the 1st of August till the 10th of October. And our late season pepper crop was not necessarily in the same quality. The fruit never had that thickness. The size wasn't quite as there. It's kind of more the traditional potassium had dropped, right? The potassium's been used up by those plants. There's a lot of potassium in that crayers, if you think about 3,000 pounds. And as the potassium gets used up, your fruit size is going to get diminished. So if you want to keep good-sized fruit, there it is. And the final thought is I often look towards the, like, exact opposite of what we hope to do long-term for my improvements. And so the next thing I will go back to when I look at peppers and I recommend for you know is just go look at hydroponic pepper production, right? It's how most of the peppers in the grocery store are produced these days. And see what they're doing in Holland for how much nutrients they're putting into those mix. And you're probably going to see they're pushing relatively high levels of potassium right through the growing season to make sure that all the potassium that gets sinked in the fruit, as you're taking that fruit away, you have something else to replace it. So, Dan?
Thank you. I think I got slides.
Oh, you did?
They're on there. That's sure.
All right. So I'm here to talk about the topic of quality and specifically research into quality. Before I get started on this topic, I want to just pass around a little clipboard, which I borrowed from the NOFA table. I didn't ask anybody, but I'll give it back. It's yours, Sharon, I was told. I asked, yeah. I asked Kathleen. She said it was Sharon's. it says for John Slack soil profile on it. I'm not sure if he told you. I think he did. I got him to commit to being down here on the third week in April to do some of those 3-foot deep soil cores across the region. So what we're looking for is a good spectrum of farms from Maine to New York. That have different underlying soil geochemistries so that John can assay, and then we can take that information and publicize it, and then hopefully be able to give farmers in different areas insight into which rock dusts from which local quarries would be most appropriate for addressing their underlying soil mineral deficiencies. So not everybody who signs up here is going to have John come. He's going to look at your address and see what your soil type is and how many other people are there in your area, and then he's going to decide where he wants to go. But if anybody wants to have that potentially happen on their farm, please feel free to.
What's it cost?
I'm not aware of any cost. Goodwill is one of his commodities he has in high at high levels. All right. So I'm wanting to report on the work the BFA has done in this past year on the topic of research and where we're going next year, and perhaps inspire some here to get engaged or tell your friends. So this is, just press the big one in the middle. All right. So we have been working for the past couple of years to get enough momentum up to do something of consequence on this topic of research. I'm not sure if our generous sponsor is over there. I don't need to name her. But we did receive $9,000 last year as a donation to work on this topic of research. We had collaboration with the Biodynamic Association and a couple of researchers from Cornell. One woman is a geneticist and the other one was an extension agent. We took corn seed and carrot seed, and we sent it to 14 different farms in 5 states. We looked at organic farms, looked at biodynamic farms, we looked at conventional farms and biological farms. Some farms are both organic and biological, or whatever, organic and biodynamic. We didn't try to be too rigorous about it, but the basic point here was to take the same seed and grow it in different soils and see what we see. The larger question here, which I'll get into in a minute, is what is the spectrum of variation in quality in the food supply? So, what's that?
Oh, she just grabbed it back instead of passing it across.
Oh. So we grew these crops out, the corn and the carrots, at these farms, and we took the samples. We said, please take the seed. This is all the seed from the same packet, so we know this, you know, that is uniform. Grow it in your soil with your management practices, with your fertility programs and your climatic conditions, and send us samples of those crops back. And we sent them to UMass and ran them through a number of metrics at the food science department. I think I just said that. Okay. So farmers were asked to follow all the typical agronomic and management practices, and we looked at the spectrum of variation in nutritional metrics in the crops produced. We specifically looked at levels of the elements, so copper, manganese, boron, zinc, etc. Those reports are not back yet. Levels of carotenoids in the carrots, alpha carotene, beta carotene. We used a handheld Raman spectrometer, which is basically a little gizmo you hold in your hand and flash a light at the carrot and it bounces back a reading. And we did a benchtop Raman microscope, which effectively gets a full spectrum of every single compound and element in the plant. We're still waiting for the data back on the elemental analysis and the benchtop Raman, but I have some basic information here. It's in your handout. So I want to just explain in general, in principle, what's going on here. This is the readings from the handheld Raman spectrometer. We had this gizmo, we took it, we flashed a light at the carrots, and this is what bounced back. In these frequency ranges, we have the frequencies of the carotenoids, alpha carotene, beta carotene, and tocopherol, and the fourth one is water. Basically, the point here is that we can use handheld gizmos to test these compounds, which are present at very low levels. It's a bit messy with this printing and the handout, but we have all of those samples from all the different farms are following that exact same profile. So we're very, very clearly seeing that compound level in the crop with a little handheld gizmo. And here we have the carotenoid levels as tested in the sort of lab bench formal chemistry at the UMass Food Science Department. And what are the peaks?
What the peaks mean.
Okay, so I like to talk about chemistry and physics and their overlays. In many cases, people were taught chemistry 1 year in school and physics a different year. And even though we're still talking about copper, we're thinking of it as a thing or as a frequency, if that makes sense. People have heard of this star called Alpha Centauri. It's roughly 9 light years away, they say. And apparently, we know exactly what's in Alpha Centauri. We know that it is 51% hydrogen and 48% helium and 1% other gases. And we know that not because we've ever been there with a microscope or any measuring tool, but we can read the frequency of the light coming off of that star. And when you get down into the nuances, every element has a vibration. It's vibrating at a certain frequency. 500 nanometers or 800 nanometers is a certain frequency at which it vibrates. And therefore, every compound is also vibrating. Right? So water is H2O, has a vibratory frequency. It's vibrating at a specific frequency. And you can look with tools at that frequency and you can see how much water is in something. So what we're seeing here are the frequencies of the carotenoids. Alpha carotene has a frequency, beta carotene has a frequency, tocopherol has a frequency. And what this meter is doing is reading the intensity of that frequency in the carot. Does that make sense? Roughly? And then what we have here is the specific numbers of alpha carotenes and beta carotenes in the carrots, depending on the farms that we're growing. And each farm has its own little code name, so nobody has to be embarrassed or too proud. But what is exciting to me is that we took the same seed from the same packet, and if you look at the yellow 160 and 83 in relation to the USDA average, we basically were able to see that some farmers with some protocols were able to produce twice as much carotene in their crops as other farmers. So we have this argument, the USDA averages, we say there's a certain amount of vitamin A in carrots, or a certain amount of vitamin C in oranges, and that's the conventional analysis. And part of what we're talking about here with this question of quality is that it seems in reality that there's a very broad spectrum of variation in crop quality. And some people will say, well, it's the genetics, it's this cultivar has more of these things and that cultivar has less of these things, hybrids are better for volume, but open pollinators are better for quality, et cetera, et cetera. We used exactly the same seed from exactly the same packet. And what we showed here was a doubling of the nutrient levels, so in this case carotenoids, based entirely on the environmental conditions. And we've got here, five farms or six farms? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 farms. So with a very small data set, we're able to show a very broad disparity in crop quality as crops are currently being grown. This is not a a test done at a university where they're doing randomized replicated trials with all the same soil. We're taking reality, what's being grown in the field by the farmers now with the way they grow crops, and what's the difference in crops.
Just to understand, but a farm is the first two rows and the next two rows?
Yeah, so A1 was one variety. I think there was red cord Chardonnay, and A2 was Bolero, maybe? I think there were two varieties of carrots we used. We did three replications for each crop, each variety. So each farm had three plots of red corn Chardonnay, three plots of Boleros, and we took three carrots from each plot and sampled them. Yes, standard deviation and all that. So this is not my strong suit, all this stuff, numbers and things, but I think I'm being intellectually correct as I've presented it thus far. So, for starters, basically,
almost always beat the USDA average, huh?
Yes, that's heartening. I suppose. what would be exciting is if we went out to California and looked at some really big farms, and what is the, or you know, went to Whole Foods and went into Donnellan's and Big Y and picked stuff off the shelf and said, what is currently available? You know, this is local farmers that, you know, people had relationships with, and we're probably going to be above the bar. Yes. Within a week or so, yeah. Fairly close. We didn't use things like tomatoes or lettuce that would break down easily. These were all pretty shelf stable. This is a prototype research project, basically. Here, this is all volunteers, $9,000. We're leading into next year's project and hopefully doing it much more well. But the point here is that even with some basic rudimentary practices, we were able to show a fairly broad disparity in crop quality, and the ability to test important compounds that are present at very low levels with a handheld meter, which has been one of our overall long-term objectives we're trying to accomplish. I don't think that was me. What's that?
I think it sounds
real. Yes, stop asking questions. All right, everybody's tired. It's been a long 2 days. So we're still waiting back for the data from UMass on the elemental levels, which will be very interesting to look at in overlays with these other compounds and the full compound spectrum from the Raman microscope. I was hoping we'd have that all in time for this conference, but we don't. So I'm expecting it in the next couple of weeks, but who knows. So that's the history of what we did this past year, and now I want to share with you what we have lined up for accomplishing this year. We basically used last year's project as a prototype to prove concept, and I think a few people here have taken the sort of the long form 19-page document that was on the table explaining the full research project, but I'm just going to lay out the basic outlines here and where we're at. So we are intending to pay our staff this year, which is always a nice thing when you want things to get done. So we've got a couple PhDs, one woman's an agronomist, and the other guy is doing all the spectral work with the different gizmos that can be used, and then we also have a high-functioning woman. Anybody know how those things work? Where you got like a business, and there's a CEO, and then there's the secretary that runs the operation. Yes. You're too tired to make jokes. All right. Yes. Well, we have one of those on board this year, and it's amazingly valuable and helpful. Anyway, so the objective is 100 farms in 35 states, not looking at two crops, but looking at eight crops, so we can actually develop a sufficiently large data set to achieve our long-term objectives. Two roots crops, two fruit crops, two leafy crops, one grain and one herb. So these are the metrics we're looking at this year. The correlations between soil type, seed variety, and source. So obviously you can get yellow brandywines from various sources, and some of them are flat and germinate slowly, and some of them are fat and germinate rapidly. So seed source, not just cultivar, we're considering to be an important component to be monitoring. Soil, mineral, and biological assay, not just the elements in the soil, but also the bacterial fungal ratios and spectra. Fertility program management practices and climactic conditions in relation to crop quality. And then crop quality will be determined by looking at all these different aspects. So the BRICS, the mineral levels, compound levels, spectral signatures, flavor, aroma, and keeping quality. At some point down the road, we'd like to do sort of animal trials where you take mice and you feed them these carrots, and you take mice and feed them those carrots, and see if it correlates with the higher nutrient levels, meaning healthier mice and things like that. So if we're actually talking about quality, what is quality from a real level? It's one thing to have the science, and it's another thing to have the empirical analysis with animals growing through their entire lifespans. So that's an entire, maybe a different conversation, but this is the overlay of what we're attempting to accomplish. So first, we want to identify, you know, if possible, what are the causal factors? Some people say it's a fertility program. Some people say it's the seed, you know, the cultivar, the family of carrots you're coming from. Some people say it's the underlying soil type. You can always grow better potatoes over here than you can grow over there. But to really build a large data set which starts to look at these things in relationship to each other, it's been really interesting the more I've been having conversations with professors at universities all across the country. And we're asking this question, what is the spectrum of variation in crop quality? No one seems to know. No one seems to have looked at this basic fact. Apparently, I've heard rumor that there was some work being done, and it showed that, you know, the potatoes grown in Idaho were always better than potatoes grown in Michigan, and so they shelved the data, because we don't want those Michigan farmers to, you know, be embarrassed. So as long as, you know, the idea basically being, as I understand it, that if you take all the potatoes and you just sort of randomly mix them, then people are getting an even mix of poor quality and decent quality. And our objective is to say that to consumers, you should be able to choose the superior quality crops if you want to, and we should let those farmers who are producing those superior quality crops be acknowledged for what they're doing. So developing the comprehensive data sets necessary to be able to give anyone who wants to know an idea of relative quality of a specific crop. So this is a follow-on to the conversation we had last night. This is a strategic position that we've taken at the BFA, is that money talks and people do vote with their dollars, and there's a very strong vested self-interest for people who buy food to get the best food they can for their family. And if we can develop the data sets to identify quality to a fairly decent degree, and then we can produce a tool that a consumer can use to test quality, we should be able to put a real wrench in the works of conventional agronomy. We should be able to really give a strong incentive to growers who are focusing on quality, because the consumers can identify who's producing that superior quality. So this is the overarching strategy. I do want to take questions, so I'll just move through the rest of this handout, and then we can maybe have a bit of a conversation. Okay, so this is what's going on currently. We have that larger document that some of you took. I've got some short one-page documents which overlay, outline roughly what we're up to. I can pass these out if people are interested later, or you can just come up and take one. Advisory board, house parties, social media campaign. We're looking for serious money this year from our perspective, which is $700,000 will pay for all the sampling at the universities, all the professors, all the, you know, salaries, et cetera. So that's the project. I've talked to a few of you here about what we're doing. So if there's any interest in support, in if you know somebody who's got a little bit of money and wants to kick in, or you have skills with Kickstarter or various endeavors, we are actively setting up house parties and talking to people who are at least somewhat well off to see if they want to make donations. Yeah, I think I've basically laid it out here, so I don't need to keep reading the slides. That's the basic upshot of what we're up to. So I'd love to have a conversation with those who have questions. Yes?
Are you picking out farmers in advance?
Are we picking out farmers in advance? We have been talking to the professors who understand how to do a proper, as I understand it, experimental design. And so the idea is that we're going to be looking at four areas of the country, and we've got collaborations with the land grants in New York, Illinois, Texas, and California. And those are going to be the major areas. They're major crop production areas, and so we haven't developed all the algorithms, Julie, but the idea is that we're going to be looking at something between a quarter and a half of the farms are going to be major producing operations, significant acreage, and then the other half to three quarters is going to be smaller operators. Our objective is to get as broad a spectrum as possible of the types of practices, so organic, conventional, biodynamic, et cetera, et cetera. Yes, we have not yet decided that. Short answer. Yes.
I
I've been having lots and lots of phone calls with statisticians. What's that? Part of the reason I haven't been in here the last couple of days is I've been continuing with my numerous phone calls with universities. Yes. No, it's a really interesting process developing a proper scientific research project. There's a lot more that goes into the front end than I had thought was necessary. But yes, the statistical, basically this was the question of, you know, have we chosen our farmers yet? No, we haven't, because we're trying to lay out the spectrum of agronomy in the country and make sure we're sampling evenly, et cetera. So, yeah, yes. I'm not worrying about that right now. Luckily, I've got PhDs who understand these things more well than I do. But yes, we are taking a lot of time to focus on the statistical design. Yes?
So back to the data that you got from this year.
Yes.
The statistics may be questionable given the small sample size, but was there any correlation between the carotenoid levels?
We are going to do the overarching analysis once we have the mineral assays back and the Raman microscope, so we can look at management practices, minerals, full compound analysis, and carotenoids specifically. The idea is that we, by looking at numerous, by measuring these crops in numerous manners, we can overlay the data sets, and we can have a better ability to find, if not causal, at least correlative factors. So we have not done that yet, but that is the agenda. Yes, we didn't say we took the soil tests, mineral balancing as well. So people roughly identified fertility programs. We didn't go into great detail this year on that. I have some personal relationship with some of the data there. So it's a touchy topic. Do you want to say anything, Julie? Julie won. Let's just say that. She had the highest carotenoid levels. Other data we have back thus far. We haven't done the full statistical analysis. We haven't monitored everything and measured everything. But with just that, you know, which farms are which, Minahan's farm was the one with the top 160%.
I was just going to, you know, you have one grain on there. I'm curious. There's so much data set that already exists for things that are used for feed corn and stuff like that. So mm-hmm. Is that going to be targeted as just an obvious choice? Or?
We were looking at soybeans in general, specifically. The idea was, the real idea here is that we are developing an open data set on what is quality. And there's, I think, a lot of conversation going on, people starting to put the two and two together and realize that the nutritional value of their food correlates with what's in their body, correlates with how sick they are or their children. And we don't have available a data set which says, you know, relatively how far apart are crops. Is it like a 15% difference in copper in between a high-quality carrot and low-quality carrot, or is it a 500% difference? The rudimentary data we have suggests it's probably something more like 500%. But until we have a really properly designed data set which says categorically, look at how profoundly disparate relative quality is in crops, only then, I think, can we really begin to push this conversation to the larger audience. You know, I'm not a big fan of science and that sort of whole, whatever it is, left-brained mode. I think my intuition is a pretty good guide, but when it comes to engaging with the culture at large, it seems like science is the safe middle ground that we use. And if we do this honestly and openly, I think we can actually have a serious conversation about agronomy and carbon sequestration and human health and, you know, agribusiness and all that kind of stuff with this as an incentive. That's the basic objective here. Objective one is to identify what is the spectrum of variation, and then we can go from that into what are best practices, what are corollary effects, and how do we test quality in real life for real people. Yes?
Will you be doing the same thing with the same seed? Because I see problems with the spectrum of soybeans.
Yes. So we are going to have each farm of the 100 farms submit samples from as many as four of their own varieties of whatever the crop is that we're growing, and we're going to send seed from one variety for all farms to grow out so that we have a baseline. This seed in every soil, that's our baseline, and then we can look at other varieties that are currently being grown to establish that more broad baseline. So we were not planning on sending any GMO soybean seed to organic farmers. I haven't dealt with that one actually yet. I hadn't thought of it. I doubt that's where we'll end up. Yes. The idea here is that we have one seed that everybody, all carrot growers are using the same seed. All tomato growers are using this one seed, and that's our baseline. So we can say what is the effect on that one cultivar of the environmental conditions, and then, you know, we do have different farmers using different seeds with different fertility programs. That's the reality of the real world. So let's try to assess what's going on in the real world and let that be a foundation for moving forward with our understanding about what quality is.
Yeah, that's really it's a first step.
Yes. So I consider this to be original research, and the biggest problem we're having is that we're not trying to make money off of it. Right? Like if I was trying to make something to sell, then I would have no problem raising money. But the fact that we're just trying to understand what is going on in the food supply and share that openly and transparently means that we're looking for donations and not investment. But it is, I consider it to be, personally, I think this is a foundational step. Yes. Well, if anybody knows any big purses that would like to support, or even medium-sized purses, please feel free to talk to me afterwards.
I'd love to see you get all the money for this
yes.
year, but if it took longer than this year to get that money, would you consider an interim step of maybe if there were 100 farmers in this room that were willing to grow out the same seed and then participate in the cost of the lab? So, because it's our land and soil, and like to do like a northeast first and then go.
Our backup plan, if we don't make enough money, is to do fewer farms and fewer crops. But we still want to continue with this experimental design where we're looking broadly across the country. And if we can't develop data sets for 8 crops, we'll develop data sets for 2 or 3 crops. And I think if we can do 1 year's basic research well, we can use that for publicity purposes to really broaden this conversation and really engage this conversation. And I don't think we're going to have problems raising money in the future. The question is how much we're going to be able to pull off this year. Really. Most people here know me and know that I've been harping on this topic for a number of years now, and I'm getting what do you call it when you stick your
here would like to support Dan's research project. So if he had on his website a downloadable little PDF that you could take out, a little pamphlet, and give to people to help with his research, I think that would be fantastic. Just go to the website, just download that.
I would suggest that we are rolling out a social media campaign, and we are doing a Kickstarter, and we are doing house parties. And if anybody has a Twitter account or a Facebook account, I guess these are the major modes of social media. I'm not sure what they all are, but we're actually doing all that too, which is I'm definitely keeping an arm's length from that. If you just check in a couple of weeks, and you know, if you've got one of those accounts and you want to see what we've got and link it or friend it or whatever you do it, tweet it, retweet it, and learning the lingo here. I think that this is a compelling thing, and it'll all be nicely presented. So thank you. Yes, I believe that many people think this is a good idea. The question is, if everybody kicks in $50, all of a sudden we're done. But getting people to each kick in that $50 is the endeavor. So for what it's worth, we are a membership-based organization, and $50 is the basic membership fee. And it's in much more detail laid out. So yes. Well, I give you these two hard copy things today. I don't think we actually have it up on the website, so that's a good idea. Yes. Yes.
Let me know when you get it.
Okay. Let you know when we get it. I will send an email out to our complete BFA list when we have the basic rudiments of this up. And our request is A, donate, if you don't mind. B, if you would link it and friend it and forward it, or however that works, do that. Yes. We are. I mean, I'm. I've been. I feel like I've been laying the groundwork for this for a while, and it's coming very clear to me somewhat recently that I'm just going to go for it. So expect to hear noise on this topic. Yeah. I got it. Don't worry, Eva. We are working on it, and thank you for your other links and suggestions as well. Yes. So, any other comments or questions? No. All right, good luck. Thank you, Derek. So it looks like it's 10 minutes to 5 up there. I think we're done early. Unless... For what?
The sign-up form for core samples still going around. Real quick, two things. Be on the lookout for a feedback form for the conference that Glenn or Gary will be sending out. And, you know, the group of us that have been planning these events, we get together generally starting in the summertime. If you have thoughts and ideas about topics or speakers that you'd like to see at the Soil Nutrition Conference next year, if we decide to make it an annual affair, let us know. We want to know. So hopefully you enjoyed the week, or the 2 days.
Yes.
I think that clipboard is going around.
Couple of things. There's a table that's perpendicular to the wall, not the table next to the wall, but almost in the center of the room that has extra food for leftovers that people are welcome to take. They're in plastic quart containers. Also, if anybody can stay around and help, that would be wonderful to help put away chairs, dishes, and so forth. And here's Ben with an announcement.
Hey everybody, just want to let you know that the NOFA Summer Conference is going to be at UMass Amherst August 14th through 16th. Our keynotes are Natasha Campbell McBride and Ronnie Cummins, and the theme is Healing the Climate, Healing Ourselves, Regeneration Through Microbiology. So I hope you guys can all come out and participate in that. Let me know if you have a workshop proposal. Thanks very much.